Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Job chapter 35, verses 1 through 16. We will call this chapter Elihu Condemns Job. Our context is this. In chapter 32, Elihu rebuked Job's three friends. In chapter 33, Elihu rebuked Job. In chapter 34, Elihu asserted God's justice as opposed to Job's idea of God. Job 35, Elihu condemns Job. So, we're in the middle of a bunch of speeches by Elihu. Now, let me give you an overview of what Elihu's position is. First of all, he's not happy with the three false friends, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. He's not happy with them because they weren't able to get Job to confess his sin. Now, there's two possible reasons why Elihu might have been mad at the three false friends. One is because he thinks the three false friends are wrong in condemning Job for a calamity-causing sin committed before the calamity arose. In other words, Elihu might have thought that Job was innocent in that, just as he said. So that would mean option two would be true, that Elihu thinks that the three false friends are blameworthy because they were not able to get Job to confess that hidden sin. So it's not clear whether Elihu really thought that Job had sinned enough to cause the calamity, or whether he had sinned in his response to the calamity after it occurred. Now, there's also some different possibilities about what Elihu thinks Job is guilty of. As I just said, option number one, he could be guilty of some calamity-causing sin before the calamity hit. Or two, he could be guilty of some sin after the calamity hit. For example, he's complaining to God improperly. He's asking for an answer when he shouldn't. He's treating God roughly in his speech. Or it could be he's not receiving the discipline of the Lord, even if he hasn't done anything to cause the suffering. He nonetheless is being chastised by the Lord. He ought to receive the discipline. Again, it's not clear. My humble opinion is that Elihu agrees with the three false friends, but he's just taking a different tack in attacking Job. He realizes Job is not going to get off his stance that he is innocent, that Job is innocent. He didn't do anything to cause the suffering. So Elihu is going to say, okay, but look what you did do. You're complaining about God in an unrighteous manner. I personally think that's what Elihu is doing, that he actually agrees with the three false friends that Job has committed a sin worthy of all the evil that's come upon Job's head. Now, I said in a previous audio, several audios actually, that Elihu was nicer about it than the three false friends, and that's probably true, but that's not really saying much because the three false friends were absolutely horrible in how they treated Job, and Elihu gets pretty rough with him too. So in this chapter, he's going to condemn Job, just like the three friends are. So we start now in Job 35, verses 1 through 3. Then Elihu continued, saying, "Do you think it is just when you say," he's talking to Job, "do you, Job, think it is just when you say, I am righteous before God? When Job says, I, Job, am righteous before God? For you ask," Elihu says, "for you, Job, ask, what does it profit you, God? What does it profit you, God?" Some translations have "me." What does it profit me? "What profit is it? What benefit comes to me if I do not sin?" Verse 1, some other translations of verse 2 actually, "Do you think it is just when you say I'm righteous before God?" The NIV says, "Do you think it's just when you say I will be cleared by God?" The NIV note says, "Do you think it is just when you say my righteousness is more than God?" Well, there's two kinds of righteousness that might be in mind here. One is sinless perfection. So Elihu is saying, "Job, do you think it's righteous when you say that you're sinlessly perfect? Sinless like Adam before he ate the fruit?" I don't believe that. It would be absurd for Elihu to say that Job was claiming that. Adam Clark says this would indeed be a blasphemous saying. Job's not blasphemous and he's not stupid. So what Elihu is accusing him of saying, "I am righteous before God," Job is saying that "I didn't do anything. I am righteous. I didn't do anything to cause all this suffering." Now, of course, the implication from that is God is unrighteous for punishing him. But Job never said that. But that's what Elihu's getting at. You're saying you're right and God's wrong. That's why Elihu is going to, in the next chapter, extol God's greatness. And in chapter 34, Elihu asserts God's justice because he believes that Job is trenching upon God's righteousness, and he's not. Job is just saying, why is this happening to me? Now, translation issue here in verse 3, Elihu says, Job, you ask, what does it profit you that you is translated me in the NIV, the New American Bible, and the Bible in Basic English. What does it profit me? For Job, you're saying, what does it profit me if I don't sin? In other words, it doesn't matter. God doesn't care about whether I'm righteous or not, because look at me, I am righteous, and yet I'm sinning like crazy. So obviously it doesn't matter whether I sin or not. It doesn't make any difference. I'm going to suffer. That's not what Job said. He's just asking why. He's not saying, look at here, God's not just. He's punishing me, even though I didn't do anything. That's a subtle difference, a big difference, though. The NIV margin and the NASB in God's Word translates it as you. What does it profit you, Job? What does it profit you, God, if I do not sin? In other words, you don't care, God, whether I sin or not. So it doesn't really matter how you translate the pronoun there, you or me. The point is Job, according to Elihu, is claiming that a righteous life doesn't matter. There's no benefit to God or to me, either way, however you look at it. Righteous life doesn't matter if I don't sin. So therefore, personal morality is irrelevant if you believe what Job believes, says Elihu. He says that God allows unrighteous people to prosper, and he allows righteous people to suffer. So therefore, righteousness or unrighteousness is irrelevant to life on this planet. That is not what Job is saying, but that's what Elihu claims that Job is saying. We go now to Job 35, verses 4 through 8. Elihu continues, I will answer you, Job, and your friends with you. Look at the heavens and see. Gaze at the clouds high above you. If you sin, how does it affect God? If you multiply your transgressions, what does it do to him? If you are righteous, what do you give him, or what does he receive from your hand? Your wickedness affects a person like yourself, and your righteousness another human being. Now, these five verses are not very easy to understand. Let's start with verse 4. I will answer you and your friends with you, Elihu says. Who are the friends? Gill and Jameson Fawcett Brown suggest these are people who are all of the same mind as Job, whether they're present or absent. And of course, the implications is it's all of the evil people who have the same evil mind as Job. As in Job 34:8, Elihu says, who goes in company with the workers of iniquity and walks with wicked men? Of course, the implication is it's Job. So that would be one option, is that Elihu is going to answer Job and all of his wicked compadres. The other option is the friends refer to the three false friends. The problem with believing that, as apparently Clark does, at least Clark mentions it as a possibility, the problem with believing that is Job would not be agreeing with the three false friends, so why does Elihu need to answer the three false friends? The three false friends more agree with Elihu than they do with Job. Well, I don't know. Friends through here usually stands for the three false friends. Maybe what Elihu was saying, I'm going to answer you, Job, and the three friends can listen to the answer at the same time, even though they more or less agree with me. And then in verse 5, Elihu says, Job, look at the heavens and see. Gaze at the clouds high above you. The point there is that the heavens are high, high, high outside of Job's reach. And so therefore, anything Job does is not going to make God do this or that. As John Gill puts it, that they, the clouds, were out of his reach and he could neither help them nor hurt them. Or the heavens were out of his reach. The heavens and the clouds both were out of Job's reach. Job could neither help the heavens nor hurt them, that he could neither increase nor diminish the light of the celestial bodies, which he could only behold, nor either advance or hinder their course, nor in the least add to or abate their influence and efficacy. And he could neither be beneficial nor harmful to them. How is it possible that he could be of any advantage or detriment to God by any actions of his, good or bad, who is higher and out of sight? In other words, Job, your actions do not affect God. Now, I'll hold that for a minute to show you where Elihu is going with the argument. Verse 7, if you are righteous, Job, what do you give him, or what does he receive from your hand? In other words, what God does, because you're righteous, and Job, I know you're claiming that you're righteous, but guess what? That doesn't affect what God does. He's too far above you to be affected by how righteous you are. So here's Elihu's argument. He says, Job, your righteousness cannot force God to be good to you. You keep complaining. You want to get rid of all your calamity and suffering. And you keep saying you're righteous. So why did this happen to me, poor pitiful me? And you think that by going to God and complaining to him that he will heal you and give you your stuff back because of your righteousness. Well, guess what, Job? Your righteousness cannot force God to be good to you. You keep saying that God doesn't punish the wicked. Well, guess what? God doesn't necessarily bless the righteous either. Job, you can't have it both ways. If you're going to say that God doesn't have to punish the wicked, as you've said many times in your discourses in the first 30 verses or so, 30 books or so of this book, if you're going to keep saying that God doesn't have to punish the wicked, well, guess what, Job? God doesn't have to bless the righteous either. As the pulpit commentator puts it, Job must not think, Elihu means, that because his good actions benefit and his bad actions injure his fellow men, therefore they must also, in the one case, injure and in the other, benefit God. Now let me back up here and pick up what pulpit is saying. If you go to the next verse, verse 8, Elihu says, Job, your wickedness affects a person like yourself. In other words, if you're righteous or unrighteous, that affects your fellow human beings, but it doesn't affect God, because God's way up there, your fellow humans are down here. Your righteousness affects another human being. So your wickedness and your righteousness affects other human beings, either for good or for bad, but they don't affect God. As the pulpit commentary says, the cases are not parallel. God is too remote, too powerful, too great to be touched by Job's actions. Job has done wrong, therefore, to expect that God would necessarily reward his righteousness by a prosperous, happy life, and worse, to complain because his expectations have been disappointed. So here we get the idea that Elihu is complaining about Job after the calamity comes. You expect to be healed from your calamity. Well, guess what? God is not affected by your righteousness. You expect to be healed from all this suffering or delivered from all this suffering. And the reason is because you haven't done anything wrong that you're righteous. Well, guess what? Your righteousness doesn't move God. He can do what he wants to do. And maybe he's doing something like perhaps disciplining you. That's where that idea comes from. Again, this is all speculation as we try to analyze Elihu's argument. Well, I would defend Job against what Elihu was saying. Job is merely saying he doesn't understand why God is not blessing him. He is not saying that God is wrong for not blessing him. Elihu is saying, Job, you're wrong for thinking that your righteousness will move God to bless you. He's too far away from you to expect that. And Job would reply, but wait a minute. I didn't say God was wrong for not blessing me. I'm just asking a question. Why? Now, it's hard to get into the minds of these characters exactly what they're thinking, but I think that's reasonable. Now, let's look at the truth or falsity of Elihu's proposition that human beings cannot affect God. If you sin, how does it affect God? If you multiply your transgressions, what does it do to him? Well, it is true that no matter what sinners do, they cannot affect the security of God. I mean, look at all the sin that has gone on in the history of the human race. The sins have been horrendous. All you have to do is read history. You think God ever thought about jumping off his throne because of that? Do you think he ever lost a minute of sleep, worrying about that? I worry about all the garbage that's going on now, like, for example, in China, like, for example, in the United States of Sodom and Gomorrah. I worry about it, but God doesn't. However, as the NIV Study Bible says, even though that humans cannot affect what God's position is, or his status, or his security, sinners, on the other hand, can affect the emotions of God because God can be deeply grieved by our sin, of course. But the main point is that God is so transcendent that man's sin will not change God in any way, as the NIV Study Bible says. Here's what John Gill says, quote, God cannot be supposed to be so affected with it to be ruffled and discomposed, affected with man's sin, to be ruffled and discomposed, or his peace be disturbed, and his happiness in the least broken upon. For affections are only attributed to him after the manner of men, anthropomorphically. Much less is he so affected hereby as to be hurt or in danger of being destroyed, nor even of being dethroned. Men can no more reach him by any hostile action of theirs, such as sin is, than they can reach the sun and stop its course, lessen its light, or pluck it from its orbit. And that's nice to know that God is a great God and he's not affected by our sin. All right, let's go back to the main point here. Elihu is saying, Job, your righteousness doesn't affect God, so don't expect him to remove your blessings just because you're righteous. And notice that Elihu does not agree necessarily that Job was righteous. He's just ad arguendo, if you want to put it that way, just for the sake of argument. He's saying, okay, if you're righteous, fine, but that does not mean that God has to stop your suffering. We go down to Job 35, verses 9 through 13. Elihu continues, "People cry out because of severe oppression. They shout for help because of the arm of the mighty. But no one asks, where is God my maker, who provides us with songs in the night, who gives us more understanding than the animals of the earth and makes us wiser than the birds of the sky? There they cry out, but he does not answer." God does not answer because of the pride of evil men. I emphasize evil men. Indeed, God does not listen to empty cries, and the Almighty does not take note of it. Now, what Elihu's argument here is, God does not answer your prayer, Job. You keep complaining about that, which Job has complained, that God's not there. And Elihu says, well, God's not going to answer empty cries of evil people. And the implication is very strong from Elihu that, Job, you are an evil person. You have committed some kind of sin, and that's why God does not answer you. Now, whether it's the sin which happened pre-calamity and caused the calamity, or whether it's the sin of how Job is dealing with God after the calamity, again, is debated. But the point is that Elihu, the larger point is that Elihu thinks that Job is a sinner. Now, in verse 9, people cry out because of severe oppression. Yeah, they cry out to man for help, but they don't cry out to God. As Elihu says, they shout for help because of the arm of the mighty. They're being oppressed by somebody with a mighty arm. In verse 10, but on the other hand, no one asks, where is God my maker? In other words, they cry out to men, but they don't cry out to God. God, who provides us with songs in the night, that could be praises of angels, the shining of moons and stars, the singing of birds at night, like the nightingale. Or maybe it could be men singing praises to God at night on their beds. Maybe it could be preservation and sleep from calamities of the night, such as fire or thieves, songs in the night. Not exactly sure what that is. All of those options were given to us by Gil. People don't cry to the God who gives us songs in the night. They don't cry to the God who gives us more understanding than the animals of the earth and makes us wiser than the birds of the sky. Well, of course, because mankind is wiser than animals and birds. Beasts and birds instinctively know that God is their creator and Lord, though. It's ironic that men of a higher order than beasts can't figure that out. They don't cry to the God that made us. Verse 12, they cry out, but he does not answer because of the pride of evil men. Now, Elihu is right about the fact that evil men do not cry out to God. Let me give you an example of that in Isaiah 1, 11 through 15. God says, "What are your multiplied sacrifices to me, says the Lord? I have had enough of burnt offerings of rams and the fat of fed cattle, and I take no pleasure in the blood of bulls, lambs, or goats. When you come to appear before me, who requires of you this trampling of my courts? Bring your worthless offerings no longer. Incense is an abomination to me. New moon and Sabbath, the calling of assemblies, I cannot endure iniquity in the solemn assembly. I hate your new moon festivals and your appointed feast. They have become a burden to me. I am weary of bearing them. So when you spread out your hands in prayer, I will hide my eyes from you. Yes, even though you multiply prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are covered with blood." So, yeah, God's not going to listen to you if your hands are covered with blood and if you are full of iniquity. So Elihu's right. He says, Elihu says this in verse 12, God does not answer because of the pride of evil men. But Elihu doesn't mention about what happens when the cries of just men and righteous men go up to God. Does he necessarily answer? No, he doesn't. And so Elihu was wrong to imply that Job was not being answered because he was wicked. Here's how the NIV Study Bible puts this. God withdraws from questions that are asked in an arrogant and insulting manner. Job never sinned against God with his words. He complained bitterly, but he never blamed God for his situation. As can be seen in God's eventual reply to Job, God did not withdraw from Job because of his questioning. The same was true of the prophets Jeremiah and Habakkuk when they complained to God. And I'll say it again, there's nothing wrong with asking God, why is this happening to me? Now, it's wrong to say, God, you were wrong for doing this to me. That would be presumptuous, blasphemous, bad. But that's not what Job did. He's just asking. And Elihu is saying, you're an evil man. You ask with evil intentions. You're proud. And that's why God's not answering. Elihu was pretty much of a jerk, just like his three friends were. We go now to Job 35, verses 14 through 16, and we'll finish this chapter. It's in the middle of a sentence, verse 14 is, so I need to go back and start at the beginning. Verse 13, indeed, God does not listen to empty cries, and the Almighty does not take note of it. Job is making an empty cry. Elihu intimates, indeed, God does not listen to empty cries, and the Almighty does not take note of it. Verse 14, how much less when you complain that you do not see him, that your case is before him and you are waiting for him. The NIV translates this, how much less then will he listen when you say that you do not see him, that your case is before him and you must wait for him. In other words, if God doesn't listen to the empty cries of evil people, how much less is he going to listen to you, Job, you slob, because you're complaining that God's not there and you have to wait for God to show up in his heavenly courtroom. He's not going to listen to you. If he doesn't listen to evil men with their empty cries, how much more is he not going to listen to you, Job? Because you're worse than that. You're complaining because you have to wait to see God. Now, it is true that Job has complained because God has not been there to meet with him. He said that in a previous chapter. I don't have the quote with me. But Job is waiting for life after death. In other words, he's waiting for an answer as to why he's suffering so much in this life. And he's impatient about that. But he is patient about waiting for life, eternal life after death. We know that because of this famous verse in Job 19, verse 25 through 27. Job says, as for me, I know that my Redeemer lives, and Redeemer there is God. And at the last, he, God, will take his stand on the earth, even after my skin is destroyed, after I'm dead, yet from my flesh I shall see God, either apart from my flesh or in my flesh. The translations are ambiguous. Yet I shall see God, whom I myself shall behold, and whom my eyes will see, and not another. My heart faints within me. So he's going to see God. So he's waiting patiently for what happens after life. But Elihu is correct when he says that Job was despairing of God answering him in this life. That's obvious. Now we go to verse 15. Elihu says, but now, Job, because God's anger does not punish and he does not pay attention to transgression, Job, you open your mouth in vain. You multiply words without knowledge. Now, what does Job mean, or what does Elihu mean when he says God's anger does not punish and he does not pay attention to transgression? Well, Ellicott, the commentator, says that what Elihu is saying is that since God has not punished Job and God has not paid attention to Job's transgression, as a result, Job feels cocky and he can go out and open his mouth in vain and multiply words without knowledge. Well, I would have a disagreement with Mr. Ellicott there. God has dealt so leniently with Job. God does not pay attention to Job's transgression. And so that's the reason that Job is talking on and on and on. Leniently, God has dealt leniently with Job. Well, let's see now. Job has lost all of his oxen, all of his donkeys, all of his camels. His servants have been killed. His sons and daughters have been wiped out. His wife has abandoned him. That's lenient? No, I don't think so. I think that what is happening here is Elihu is ironically referring to Job's previous arguments that the wicked prosper. So in verse 15, what Elihu is saying, okay, Job, you say that God's anger does not punish, that wicked people prosper, and that God does not pay attention to transgression to punish it, because you hold this foolish belief that you are suffering not because of your sin, because God doesn't punish sin. You hold to that foolish belief. That's why you open your mouth in vain. I think that makes a lot more sense than Mr. Ellicott. Now a few textual notes here. Verse 15, Elihu says, now because God's anger does not punish and he does not pay attention to transgression. That word for transgression in the Hebrew is obscure and uncertain, as the NIV note says. The NIV translates it as wickedness. Yeah, big deal. It's interesting, the Bible in basic English just leaves the whole verse out and replaces the verse with three dots. And this is what the note says in the Bible in basic English. Three dots are used where it is no longer possible to be certain of the true sense of the Hebrew words. And for this reason, no attempt has been made to put them into basic English. Please, at least make an attempt. I've never seen a translation do that before. Transgression naturally makes sense, and most of the translations have got something on that order there, transgression. God does not pay attention to transgression. Is that what you're saying, Job? Yes, he does. Because look at you. You're suffering. He's paid attention to your transgression. So why don't you go ahead and confess it? Which Job, of course, is not willing to do. And so the battle continues. We're finished with chapter 35. We are now prepared to go to chapter 36, verses 1 through 33. in which Elihu extols God's greatness. In other words, the same old arguments. God is great. Job, you're a slob. You're a worm. You're a slug. You're pitiful. Therefore, you're sinning. God is great. Why don't you confess your worthlessness before God? Great comfort these guys are. We'll see you next audio, and hope you enjoyed this one.